They were more than weary, and yet there seemed no comfort in the thought of halting anywhere. Frodo's spirits had risen for a while after his escape, and after food and a draught of the cordial, but now a deep uneasiness, growing to dread, crept over him again. Though he had been healed in Rivendell of the knife-stroke, that grim wound had not been without effect. His senses were sharper and more aware of things that could not be seen. One sign of change that he soon had noticed was that he could see more in the dark than any of his companions, save perhaps Gandalf. And he was in any case the bearer of the ring. It hung upon its chain against his breast, and at whiles it seemed a heavy weight. He felt the certainty of evil ahead and of evil following, but he said nothing. He gripped tighter on the hilt of his sword and went on doggedly. The company behind him spoke seldom, and then only in hurried whispers. There was no sound but the sound of their own feet. The dull stamp of Gimli's dwarf boots, the heavy tread of Boromir, the light step of Legolas, the soft, scarce-heard patter of hobbit feet, and in the rear the slow, firm footfalls of Aragorn with his long stride. When they halted for a moment, they heard nothing at all, unless it were occasionally a faint trickle and a drip of unseen water. Yet Frodo began to hear, or to imagine that he heard, something else, like the faint fall of soft, bare feet. It was never loud enough, or near enough, for him to feel certain that he heard it, but once it had started, it never stopped, while the company was moving. But it was not an echo, for when they halted, it pattered on for a little while all by itself, and then grew still. It was after nightfall when they had entered the mines. They'd been going for several hours with only brief halts, when Gandalf came to his first serious check. Before him stood a wide, dark arch opening into three passages. All led in the same general direction, eastwards. But the left-hand passage plunged down, while the right-hand climbed up, and the middle way seemed to run on, smooth and level, but very narrow.
"I have no memory of this place at all," said Gandalf, standing uncertainly under the arch.
He held up his staff in the hope of finding some marks or inscription that might help his choice, but nothing of the kind was to be seen. "I'm too weary to decide," he said, shaking his head, "and I expect that you are all as weary as I am, or wearier. We'd better halt here for what is left of the night. You know what I mean. In here it's ever dark, but outside the late moon is riding westward, and the middle night has passed."
"Poor old Bill," said Sam. "I wonder where he is. I hope those wolves haven't got him yet."
To the left of the great arch they found a stone door. It was half closed, but swung back easily to a gentle thrust. Beyond there seemed to lie a wide chamber cut in the rock.
"Steady, steady," cried Gandalf as Merry and Pippin pushed forward, glad to find a place where they could rest with at least more feeling of shelter than in the open passage. "Steady. You do not know what is inside yet. I'll go first."
He went in cautiously, and the others filed behind.
"There," he said, pointing with his staff to the middle of the floor. Before his feet they saw a large round hole like the mouth of a well. Broken and rusty chains lay at the edge and trailed down into the black pit. Fragments of stone lay near. "One of you might have fallen in and still be wondering when you were going to strike the bottom," said Aragorn to Merry. "Let the guide go first while you have one."
"This seems to have been a guard room made for the watching of the three passages," said Gimli. "That hole was plainly a well for the guard's use, covered with a stone lid. But the lid is broken, and we must all take care in the dark."
Pippin felt curiously attracted by the well. While the others were unrolling blankets and making beds against the walls of the chamber, as far as possible from the hole in the floor, he crept to the edge and peered over. A chill air seemed to strike his face, rising from invisible depths. Moved by a sudden impulse, he groped for a loose stone and let it drop. He felt his heart beat many times before there was any sound. Then far below, as if the stone had fallen into deep water in some cavernous place, there came a plunk, very distant, but magnified and repeated in the hollow shaft.
"What's that?" cried Gandalf.
He was relieved when Pippin confessed what he had done, but he was angry, and Pippin could see his eyes glinting.
"Fool of a Took," he growled. "This is a serious journey, not a hobbit walking party. Throw yourself in next time, and then you'll be no further nuisance. Now be quiet."
Nothing more was heard for several minutes, but then there came out of the depths faint knocks. Tom-tap, tap-tom. They stopped, and when the echoes had died away, they were repeated. Tap-tom, tom-tap, tap-tap, tom. They sounded disquietingly, like signals of some sort, but after a while the knocking died away and was not heard again.
"That was the sound of a hammer, or I've never heard one," said Gimli.
"Yes," said Gandalf, "and I don't like it. It may have nothing to do with Peregrine's foolish stone, but probably something has been disturbed that would have been better left quiet. Pray, do nothing of the kind again. Let us hope we shall get some rest without further trouble. You, Pippin, can go on the first watch as a reward," he growled, as he rolled himself in a blanket.
Pippin sat miserably by the door in the pitch dark, but he kept on turning round, fearing that some unknown thing would crawl up out of the well. He wished he could cover the hole, if only with a blanket, but he dared not move or go near it, even though Gandalf seemed to be asleep. Actually, Gandalf was awake, though lying still and silent. He was deep in thought, trying to recall every memory of his former journey in the mines, and considering anxiously the next course that he should take. A false turn now might be disastrous. After an hour, he rose up and came over to Pippin.
"Get into a corner and have a sleep, my lad," he said in a kinder tone. "You want to sleep, I expect. I can't get a wink, so I may as well do the watching." "I know what is the matter with me," he muttered, as he sat down by the door. "I need smoke. I've not tasted it since the morning before the snowstorm."
The last thing that Pippin saw, as sleep took him, was a dark glimpse of the old wizard huddled on the floor, shielding a growing chip in his gnarled hands between his knees. The flicker for a moment showed his sharp nose and the puff of smoke. It was Gandalf who roused them all from sleep. He had sat and watched all alone for about 6 hours, and had let the others rest.
"And in the watches I've made up my mind," he said. "I don't like the feel of the middle way, and I don't like the smell of the left-hand way. There's foul air down there, or I'm no guide. I shall take the right-hand passage. It's time we began to climb up again." For 8 dark hours, not counting 2 brief halts, they marched on, and they met no danger, and heard nothing, and saw nothing but the faint gleam of the wizard's light, bobbing like a will-o'-the-wisp in front of them. The passage they had chosen wound steadily upwards. As far as they could judge, it went in great mounting curves, and as it rose, it grew loftier and wider. There were now no openings to other galleries or tunnels on either side, and the floor was level and sound, without pits or cracks. Evidently, they had struck what once had been an important road, and they went forward quicker than they had done on their first march. In this way, they advanced some 15 miles, measured in a direct line east, though they must have actually walked 20 miles or more. As the road climbed upwards, Frodo's spirits rose a little, but he still felt oppressed, and still at times he heard, or thought he heard, away behind the company and beyond the fall and patter of their feet, a following footstep that was not an echo. They had marched as far as the hobbits could endure without a rest, and all were thinking of a place where they could sleep, when suddenly the walls to right and left vanished.
They seemed to have passed through some arched doorway into a black and empty space. There was a great draught of warmer air behind them, and before them the darkness was cold on their faces. They halted and crowded together anxiously. Gandalf seemed pleased.
"I chose the right way," he said. "At last we're coming to the habitable parts, and I guess that we are not far now from the Eastern Gate. But we're high up, a good deal higher than the Dimrill Gate, unless I'm mistaken. From the feeling of the air, we must be in a wide hall. I will now risk a little real light." He raised his staff, and for a brief instant there was a blaze like a flash of lightning.
Great shadows sprang up and fled, and for a second they saw a vast roof far above their heads upheld by many mighty pillars hewn of stone. Before them, and on either side, stretched a huge empty hall. Its black walls, polished and smooth as glass, flashed and glittered. Three other entrances they saw, dark black arches. One straight before them eastwards, and one on either side. Then the light went out.
"This is all that I shall venture on for the present," said Gandalf. "There used to be great windows on the mountainside, and shafts leading out to the light in the upper reaches of the mines. I think we've reached them now, but it's night outside again, and we can't tell until morning. If I'm right, tomorrow we may actually see the morning peeping in. But in the meanwhile, we'd better go no further. Let us rest if we can. Things have gone well so far, and the greater part of the dark road is over. But we're not yet through, and it's a long way down to the gates that open on the world."
The company spent that night in the great cavernous hall, huddled close together in a corner to escape the draught. There seemed to be a steady inflow of chill air through the eastern archway. All about them as they lay hung the darkness, hollow and immense, and they were oppressed by the loneliness and vastness of the dolven halls and endlessly branching stairs and passages. The wildest imaginings that dark rumour had ever suggested to the hobbits fell altogether short of the actual dread and wonder of Moria.
"There must have been a mighty crowd of dwarves here at one time," said Sam, "and every one of them busier than badgers for 500 years to make all this, and most in hard rock, too. What did they do it all for? They didn't live in these darksome holes, surely."
"These are not holes," said Gimli. "This is the great realm and city of the Dwaradelph. And of old it was not darksome, but full of light and splendor, as is still remembered in our songs."
He rose, and standing in the dark, he began to chant in a deep voice, while the echoes ran away into the roof.
"The world was young, the mountains green, no stain yet on the moon was seen, no words were laid on stream or stone, when Durin woke and walked alone. He named the nameless hills and dells, he drank from yet untasted wells, he stooped and looked in mirror, and saw a crown of stars appear, as gems upon a silver thread, above the shadow of his head. The world was fair, the mountains tall, in elder days before the fall of mighty kings in Nargothrond and Gondolin, who now beyond the western seas have passed away. The world was fair in Durin's day. A king he was on carven throne, in many pillared halls of stone, with golden roof and silver floor, and runes of power upon the door. The light of sun and star and moon, in shining lamps of crystal hewn, undimmed by cloud or shade of night, there shone forever fair and bright. Their hammer on the anvil smote, their chisel clove and graver wrote, there forged was blade and bound was hilt, the delver mined, the mason built, their beryl pearl and opal pale, and metal wrought like fisher's mail, buckler and corslet, axe and sword, and shining spears were laid in hoard. Unwearied then were Durin's folk. Beneath the mountain's music woke. The harpers harped, the minstrels sang, and at the gates the trumpets rang. The world is grey, the mountain's old, the forge's fire is ashen cold. No harp is rung, no hammer falls, the darkness dwells in Durin's halls. The shadows lie upon his tomb in Moria, in Khazad Dûm. But still the sunken stars appear in dark and windless Middlemere. There lies his crown in water deep, till Durin wakes again from sleep.
I like that, said Sam. I should like to learn it.
In Moria, in Khazad Dûm.
But it makes the darkness seem heavier, thinking of all those lamps. Are there piles of jewels and gold lying about there still? Gimli was silent. Having sung his song, he would not say more.
Piles of jewels?
Said Gandalf. No, the orcs have often plundered Moria. There's nothing left in the upper halls. And since the dwarves fled, no one dares to seek the shafts and treasures down in the deep places. They're drowned in water or in a shadow of fear.
Then what do the dwarves want to come back for? Asked Sam.
For Mithril, answered Gandalf. The wealth of Moria was not in gold and jewels, the toys of the dwarves, nor in iron, their servant. Such things they found here, it is true, especially iron. But they did not need to delve for them. All things that they desired they could obtain in traffic. For here alone in the world was found Moria silver, or true silver, as some have called it. Mithril is the elvish name. The dwarves have a name which they do not tell. Its worth was 10 times that of gold, and now it's beyond price, for little is left above ground, and even the orcs dare not delve here for it. The lodes lead away north towards Carathras, and down to darkness. The dwarves tell no tale, but even as Mithril was the foundation of their wealth, so also it was their destruction. They delved too greedily and too deep, and disturbed that from which they fled. Durin's bane, of what they brought to light, the orcs have gathered nearly all, and given it in tribute to Sauron, who covets it. Mithril, all folk desired it. It could be beaten like copper and polished like glass, and the dwarves could make of it a metal light and yet harder than tempered steel. Its beauty was like to that of common silver, but the beauty of Mithril did not tarnish or grow dim. The elves dearly loved it, and among many uses they made of it, Ithildin, Star Moon, which you saw upon the doors. Bilbo had a corset of Mithril rings that Thorin gave him. I wonder what has become of it. Gathering dust still in Mickle Delving Mathem House, I suppose. What?
Cried Gimli, startled out of his silence.
A corselet of Moria silver? That was a kingly gift.
Yes, said Gandalf. I never told him, but its worth was greater than the value of the whole shire and everything in it. Frodo said nothing, but he put his hand under his tunic and touched the rings of his mail shirt. He felt staggered to think that he had been walking about with the price of the shire under his jacket. Had Bilbo known? He felt no doubt that Bilbo knew quite well. It was indeed a kingly gift. But now his thoughts had been carried away from the Dark Mines to Rivendell, to Bilbo, and to Bag End in the days while Bilbo was still there. He wished with all his heart that he was back there, and in those days, mowing the lawn, or pottering among the flowers, and that he had never heard of Moria, or Mithril, or the ring. A deep silence fell. One by one the others fell asleep. Frodo was on guard. As if it were a breath that came in through unseen doors out of deep places, dread came over him. His hands were cold and his brow damp. He listened. All his mind was given to listening and nothing else for 2 slow hours. But he heard no sound, not even the imagined echo of a footfall.